Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News tonight.
He was grabbed immediately from the airport, and someone was questioning why he was being arrested in such a kind of a manner. And he was just immediately taken to a vehicle, speeding vehicle that rushed him to his home in Magele.
That's reporter Mugume Davis Rawakarinji saying Ugandan opposition figure and pop star Bobby Wine was taken into custody. Details coming up. Also, Sudan's warring factions swap accusations. And Niger's defense ministry says at least 29 soldiers have been killed in an attack near the border with Mali. These stories and more on African News tonight.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America.
But first, our top story. Niger's defense ministry says at least 29 soldiers have been killed in an attack near the border with Mali during military operations aimed at neutralizing the threat posed by an Islamic State militant group in the area. And Mali's northern Tuareg rebels said yesterday they seized another military base from the Malian army after taking four camps in recent weeks. David DeRoche, associate professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Basically, what this does is this puts the lie to the justification for the coup. I mean, in Mali, of course, you had a desire to replace what seemed to be a relatively effective French-led counterinsurgency effort. And counterinsurgency takes a long time. It requires a lot of soldier discipline. It requires patience. You replaced it with a Wagner group-led effort that, quite frankly, has been genocidal. It's empowered some ethnic groups and has waged war and, you know, there are documented killings of thousands of Malians who don't belong to favored groups. In Niger, we know that there is Russian support. We haven't seen the same level of Wagner involvement, but there was support again for the expulsion of the French with this idea that military men will clear things up quickly, you know, and basically apply brutality. That very rarely works. Usually that philosophy incubates insurgency. And what we've seen, particularly in Mali or with the Tuareg, who, you know, are active in eastern Mali, western Niger, they view themselves as suspect by both of those governments, and they're not going to knuckle under to that. So I think that this sort of trouble is a direct result of the poor decisions made by these military juntas. And it shows that when the military gets involved in government, you get poor government, and you also get a bad military.
So how do you explain the rise of terrorist attacks in the two countries following the two military takeover?
With one exception, Uruguay, there's never been an insurgency or a really effective terrorist movement in a country that is a democracy. In general, terrorism and insurgencies are a function of either poor government or outside support. What you have across the Sahel is poor government, you know, lack of development, high levels of corruption. And the antidote to these insurgencies is a combination of effective security actions, but not indiscriminate security actions like you're seeing with the Wagner group in Mali, and enhanced government that provides services and democratic accountability. With these coups, you've got exactly the opposite in the name of security. You can get some short-term benefits and you can kill a lot of people, but you can't deliver governance. So unless you completely eliminate ethnically different populations where these people, where the insurgency draws its support from, you'll always have an insurgency problem. That's you know, military theory and political science theory all agree on that. So the violence we're seeing is a direct result of the ineffectiveness of military rule, particularly in a country where the militaries, quite frankly, are not very good.
Following the withdrawal of the UN from Mali and then the French troops from Niger, the United States still maintains around 1,000 troops in Niger and a base for drones. Could the U.S. fill the current gap in Sahel counterterrorism?
I don't think so. I mean, we can provide key enabling, we can provide observation. But again, at the end of the day, this counterterrorism effort has to be conducted with the support of local populations. And if you have what are basically despotic rule, generally by people who are drawn from one ethnic group in a multinational, multi-ethnic nation, you're always going to have some sort of problem. You're always going to have some form of political violence. And the United States, with the small number of forces we have committed there, we can move against certain high-value targets. We can move against organizations that are moving transnationally. But at the end of the day, the insurgency will draw its support from people who view their government as oppressive. And that's a function of governance that the United States can't impose.
That was David DeRoche, Associate Professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. At least 20 people were killed and scores of others injured after a rocket hit a health center in the Samrab neighborhood in Sudan's Khartoum, northern neighborhood of the capital. Witnesses say a rocket hit El Amda Health Center Wednesday, killing 17 people immediately. Mohammed Jafar, a member of an emergency committee in Samrab neighborhood, told the reporter Michael Atit that three people later died from their injuries. Jafar says the damaged health center is one of three providing health services in the suburbs of North Khartoum. Brigadier General Nabil Abdullah, spokesperson of the Sudan Armed Forces, condemned the attack, and on Al Hadat TV, he accused the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, of targeting the health center. The Rapid Support Forces denied carrying out the attack. Via a messaging application early today, Al-Mak Abu Sotan, the RSF commander for Khartoum's north, told VOA the Sudan Armed Forces bombed the health center. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of the Humanitarian Affairs says since April it has identified at least 53 attacks on health care facilities. A senior UN official today has warned Sudan's population is living on a knife's edge and is at risk of falling off the cliff if the world does not step up to help them in their hour of need. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UN statistics show Sudan has become the world's fastest growing displacement crisis since two rival generals plunged the country into war nearly 6 months ago. Some 5.4 million people are either displaced within Sudan or in neighboring countries as refugees. UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in Sudan, Clementine Nkweta Salami, says this conflict has upended millions of lives, causing untold suffering and despair.
I have met mothers in Sudan who've told me they don't know where to find the next meal for their children. I've met families sleeping in makeshift shelters, struggling to find food and water, unable to access healthcare. Their children out of school and the family breadwinners out of work.
The outlook is bleak. Nkweta Salami says half of Sudan's 24.7 million people need aid and protection. 70% of all hospitals are not functioning. Sexual and gender-based violence is rampant. Disease and hunger is on the rise. To make matters worse, she says the warring parties do not keep their promises.
4 months ago, the parties meeting in Sudan committed to de-escalate the fighting, minimize civilian harm, and refrain from any disproportionate attacks. But since then, the killing of civilians has continued in Khartoum, in Nuera, in Al-Fasha, and other areas.
She says UN agencies have been able to deliver aid to at least 3.6 million people through two main access points, Port Sudan and from Chad to Darfur. She says more people could be reached if these efforts were not hampered by bureaucratic obstacles, forced checks of humanitarian trucks, and criminal activities such as the looting of trucks by armed groups. Nkweta Salami says without a cessation of hostilities and a permanent ceasefire, the conflict in Sudan risks becoming a protracted crisis. If the conflict is not ended, she warns it will have a spillover effect in the region, something to be avoided at all costs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Security analysts say cyber criminals based in South Africa are increasingly targeting victims in Africa and around the world. According to the investigators, the criminals are targeting Africa's stronger economies, including Ethiopia, Kenya, and South Africa itself, but also West Africa, Europe, and the United States. Darren Taylor reports.
International anti-crime groups like Interpol say global cybercrime gangs, including Nigeria's Black Axe, have long used South Africa as a base from which to defraud people around the world. Black Axe has, for example, stolen hundreds of millions of dollars from women, many in the United States, using online romance scams. Director of TCG Forensics in Johannesburg, Craig Pedersen, says South Africa's undoubtedly Africa's cybercrime capital. He says cyber criminals, from large organizations to individuals operating from dingy internet cafes, are taking advantage of South Africa's good telecoms infrastructure. Another plus for perpetrators, says Pedersen, is the country's sophisticated financial and banking systems, offering the criminals speedy highways to move money wherever they want.
Cybercrime is one of those crimes that is scalable. If you're going to scam one person, you may as well scam 10. It's the same amount of work. If you're going to do one invoice interception, you may as well do 10 or 20, same amount of work. We're really struggling with the volumes in South Africa in terms of how many victims are coming forward and reporting crimes on a daily basis.
Wendy Nola, a journalist investigating cybercrime, says a current favorite of South Africa-based online scammers is to set up fake websites. She says the criminals use these to steal money from international online shoppers.
They will just Google a particular brand of sneakers, say, or trainers, maybe add the city that they're in. They'll get a result. They'll get a few results. And they click on and they start looking at the lovely merchandise. And usually the price is good. There's a sale. And they click, they pay, and then they don't get the goods. They're not checking the URL. They're not looking to see if their contact details. They're not thinking about, what if I need to contact this company? If something goes wrong, can I contact them? It's just instant gratification, sort of not.
Pedersen's traced victims across the continent, from Egypt to Ethiopia, Nigeria to Kenya. He says cyber criminal networks have many interlinked bank accounts, so it's very difficult for banks to detect suspicious activity, simply because it isn't suspicious, because it involves small amounts of money. He says the criminals operate with relative impunity because South African law enforcement doesn't have the technical capacity to investigate cybercrime.
We've got the court system that also needs to play catch-up and start getting more automated in our courtrooms. We should have dedicated cyber courts. We should have courts that are set up specifically and equipped and staffed to hear cyber matters. I mean, the reality is quite simple. Cyber is not going to go away. It's only going to get worse.
But in a country where a judicial system battles huge backlogs of cases involving multiple murders, Pedersen acknowledges that for the moment, this is wishful thinking. According to an Interpol report, there were 230 million cyber threats detected in South Africa in 2021, the most on the continent. Pedersen says this number is now likely much higher. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Africa is experiencing a significant surge in energy demand, reinforcing the importance to foster inclusive and clean energy solutions to ensure the demands are met sustainably. Reporter Ruben Chama spoke with Alice Goodbrook, the innovation lead and head of the Energy Catalyst and Innovate UK program funded by Britain's Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. She starts by explaining how the initiative is supporting clean energy transition in Africa.
So the Energy Catalyst mission is to accelerate the innovation needed to reach Sustainable Development Goal 7. We provide financial and advisory support to innovators to help create strategic partnerships, uncover insights, and to develop business models to improve lives in Africa and Asia. And that main part of the programme is the competition. So we'll release anything up to £40 million at a time for people to apply into to be able to do these innovative projects. And then everyone that's successful through the Energy Catalyst competitions gets access to the Energy Catalyst Accelerator programme, which provides business support anywhere from kind of doing your business plan all the way up to looking for investments and hiring the first member of staff.
What is its impact on communities and countries across Africa?
So the impact is kind of twofold. On a basic level, the main impact communities are getting are access to energy. So these may be kind of communities that have never had energy before and have been relying on things like kerosene for light for many years or wood for cooking. And therefore, we're going into these communities and these projects are having business models which are enabling the people at the bottom of the pyramid to get access for the first time. But we also look at things like grid stability, for example, in South Africa. They have lots of load shedding, lots of power outages. And so therefore, we're trying to improve the reliability of the grid and to make it greener. And this obviously enables economic development. Emerging economies need to develop if there is going to be kind of progress through emerging economies. And without energy, there's no communication, no internet, the hours of work are reduced. So it's a really key kind of economic enabler to get energy into communities. So the second kind of impact is the fact that we can develop IP from across the world. So that means that we're not just developing the UK IP, but actually local communities and local businesses can apply into funding to develop their own. This means that we're building more local businesses of resilience, and so that the innovations are kind of matching the local specific needs, but they're also embedded into the local infrastructure and therefore more likely to be a success.
What are some of the most significant setbacks or impediments to upscaling clean energy, especially in developing countries?
The first one is finance. These are not easy markets to work in. It's why Energy Catalyst is so important, because we're providing this funding to be able to scale these early stage technologies. And without this finance, they're not going to be able to kind of do the scaling or be able to develop and make them sustainable in the long term. But I think also it's been really kind of true during COVID, like the supply chains are particularly difficult at the moment. So trying to get things across country, especially when they're new innovations or renewables or things where the specific countries haven't got the policies to, I guess, import them, it's been a real big setback because people can't physically get the technologies into countries in to be able to test it and to show that it works and then to develop it into the market. And this is why kind of local manufacturing and things like that are so important, because if you're building it in country, you do not have these kind of supply chain issues.
That was Alice Goodbrook, Innovation Lead and Head of the Energy Catalyst Program, speaking with reporter Ruben Chama from Nairobi. Uganda's main opposition party says its leader, Robert Chagulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine, was detained today as he was stepping off a plane in Entebbe from a trip abroad. Police say they merely accompanied him to his residence. A video posted by Wine's National Unity Platform on messaging platform X shows police leading the former presidential candidate away. Reporter Mugume Davis Rawakaringi in Kampala describes to VOA's Carol Van Dam what happened.
He went to Canada and he went to South Africa, where he's trying to mobilize for his supporters. Upon his arrival at the airport, he was grabbed by the police, by the security officers, in a video that was posted by an anonymous person. We couldn't know who it was. He was rushed immediately to his family, to his home, because that's what happened.
The way he describes the two journalists later, he was saying that they handled him kind of roughly?
Yes. According to the video that was posted on social media, it was posted on X, he was grabbed immediately from the airport. And someone was questioning why he was being arrested in such a kind of a manner. Yeah, and he was just rushed, immediately taken to a vehicle, speeding vehicle, that rushed him to his home in Magele.
Now, this isn't the first time that he's been detained or arrested. Can you give us a little history of what's been going on with Bobi Wine and the security and just his last run for president?
Yeah, so immediately after the presidential elections, he had been he was put under house arrest as well. But just recently, he has been on the countrywide tour, mobilizing supporters all over the country. At first, the police had okayed his travel, his tour all over the country, but they eventually said they do not want him to go ahead with it, and they said they would arrest him if he goes on with it. With the party mobilization all over the country, of which he said he adamantly said he would definitely keep on doing the mobilization. So before coming, his supporters had organized to welcome him, and his party had said they will have him proceed to his probably his office or his home in Magere, in what they had said it was going to be a 1 million walk. So it was expected that many people are going to welcome him along the way from Entebbe Airport to his home, probably to his office. And the police said they were not going to accept this because usually they were expecting it was going to cause a lot of traffic jam along the road. And so they said they would not allow him to go ahead with his procession. That's probably the reason they arrested him at the airport immediately after upon embarking from the airport.
Is that legal? I understand how the police would say you can't do this million-man march, but is it legal for the police to say anybody that's out on the street who's there to just greet him will be arrested? Is that legal in Uganda?
No, there's no law that says someone cannot have such a kind of procession as long as you're doing it peacefully, as long as you're not interrupting any person. Yeah, but the police definitely, they say, they don't say they were not just prohibiting him from having a procession, but they're saying the procession would consequently bring hold to traffic. Maybe there would be chaos along the way, and that's what the police is claiming.
And is he still the strongest challenger to President Yoweri Museveni, who's, as you know, been in power since 1986?
That definitely is still a strong person. His party, the National Unity Platform, is the one that has the highest number of MPs in the national parliament. And himself, he's been popular since he contested for MP, and he won by a landslide. And he still remains a very, very popular person in Uganda.
That's reporter Mugume Davis Rawakarenji speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Kampala. Norway's Jon Fosse, whose plays are among the most widely staged of any contemporary playwright, won the Nobel Prize in Literature today. The French news agency AFP says Fosse is sometimes compared with Samuel Beckett, another Nobel-winning playwright, because his work relies on simple language, which delivers its message through rhythm, melody, and silence. The Swedish Academy said the 64-year-old was honored for his innovative plays and prose, which give voice to the unsayable. Fosse's writing is defined more by form than content, where what is not said is often more revealing than what is. The jury said Fosse presents everyday situations that are instantly recognizable in our own lives. His radical reduction of language and dramatic action expresses the most powerful human emotions of anxiety and powerlessness in the simplest terms. Tomorrow, the Swedish Academy will announce the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.